And a big thank you to all of our program sponsors, including our sponsors here of this program, Current State, on 90.5 WKAR. The Thanksgiving season is here. Thanksgiving is 15 days away. A big thank you to all of our generous donors, Legacy Circle, corporate underwriters, and all of our volunteers. You're an important part of the WKAR family, and we thank you. At the top of our program here today for Wednesday, it's a natural human instinct to protect our head. Even in ancient times, soldiers knew the value of shielding the brain with strong helmets. Just look at the ubiquitous Michigan State University Spartan logo. Now, over the last decade, there's been significantly more awareness about traumatic brain injury, whether it's suffered in battle or on an athletic field. TBI has been called the signature wound of the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. One mid-Michigan rehab clinic is part of a national program to help veterans with TBI. And Current State's Kevin Lavery joins me now with more. Kevin, where is this place?
Mark, it is outside the city of Mason. The Origami Brain Injury Rehabilitation Center is near woods, fields, and farms. The staff there will tell you that that is a quiet, natural setting that is absolutely essential to their patients' recovery. Origami is one of just 20 facilities in the country that works with the VA to provide assisted living services to TBI veterans, so I decided to see what they're all about.
The day I visited the Origami Brain Injury Rehabilitation Center in Mason, they had just had a power outage that affected most of the buildings. But it was okay, because Tammy Hanna and her staff did what they do every day. Turn the lights back on.
You know, therapy happens outside of the clinic. So when the clinic is dark, we go outside or we go where there is light. We improvise quite well and we're used to being very creative.
So you're making it through.
We definitely are making it through. So this is our courtyard. The design is purposeful. So this is a great area for our clients to come out and maybe just relax. Sometimes it's a strategy. Disinhibition is a common symptom after a brain injury where they're not able to filter and collect themselves. And sometimes, you know, the stop, think, and then act strategy is imposed. And the stop and think is oftentimes it can be the courtyard. It's a very relaxing environment. It's quiet. But people come out here to garden. They'll come out here and they'll enjoy conversation with family members or their peers. On sunny days, you'll see them eating a meal out here. It's just a calming area. Do you feel calm out here, even on a colder day?
I feel cold out here, but also calm.
You need a coat, and then you'll really enjoy it.
Fortunately, the residential building where most of the services are provided did have power. It runs on a generator. So Tammy, Hanna, and I went back inside to talk about the origin of the name of her clinic, Origami.
Our philosophy at Origami is unfolding potentials. So it's a play on words with paper folding, but we also look at it as when people come to us in need, you know, we can kind of compare it to a flat piece of paper that has so much potential. And as we work with them with our therapies, and similar to as an artist is working with the piece of paper, it takes form, it takes flight. The crane is also symbolic of, you know, great potential. And so Origami is just, that's a play on words and being able to really say that, you know, there's a lot of potential when people come to us, and when they leave, they fly off as independently as possible.
What is really the threshold for a traumatic brain injury? All of us bump our head now and then on something, and usually it just goes away if it's not real severe. But what is really the level that makes something a traumatic brain injury?
Brain injuries come in all different forms. You know, everybody's so different in their own way, right? And so a brain injury, for one, is very different for another. Brain injury has become a lot more of a hot topic. You know, we hear a lot about brain injury with the veterans. We hear a lot about it from sports concussions. And I think with the greater awareness that the community and even professionals have, they're being detected a lot quicker. I think there, you know, there used to be a greater frequency of individuals going to maybe urgent cares or going to the emergency room and saying something just isn't right. I have this persistent headache, I have double vision, my balance isn't quite right, whatever their situation is after bumping their head. And they would be sent home and just asked, you know, follow up with your primary care physician. Now people recognize that there needs to be more of a formal follow-up. and making sure that these symptoms are resolving on their own. They don't always resolve on their own, and that's where Origami comes in. We can help to assess a situation, whether it's a mild brain injury or a severe brain injury, and really determine what's going on. How is this person functioning differently from how they were prior to their injury? And then start to identify the care plan, the treatment that's necessary for them. So we see individuals of all sorts. We see individuals maybe for one-time evaluation and determine that, you know, you can return to work, you can return to playing sports, you've recovered. And then we see other people, even with a mild brain injury, who need 4 weeks of therapy, whether it's vestibular rehab or vision therapy. So we really work with a population that there is no recipe. It's very individualized. Our professionals are specialized in exactly what they need to assess for each individual's injury.
We're talking with Tammy Hanna, the executive director of the Origami Brain Injury Rehabilitation Center in Mason. This clinic is one of just 20 in the country that's part of a pilot program that is working with veterans. Are there specific things that brain injury specialists have to think about when they are treating veterans? And I realize not every veteran has a combat wound, but many of them do in our country.
Well, Origami is very honored to be able to be part of the VA's Assisted Living Traumatic Brain Injury Pilot Program. This program came about in 2011 after a lot of work within the VA walls of determining how are they going to continue to treat vets with traumatic brain injury that are ready to return back into their own communities, back to where their families are located. They're veterans. It's not necessarily a traumatic brain injury that's a result of combat. It doesn't have to be related to a combat injury. There is strict criteria, and the VA determines who participates in the program, but it's designed for individuals that have a rehab potential and have a need for 24/7 assisted living, as well as comprehensive rehab services in order to really maximize their independence, their quality of life, and prepare them for a transition back to their family and back into their own home in the community.
But what is traumatic brain injury therapy really all about day to day? For that, I asked Amanda Carr, the clinical manager and occupational therapist at Origami.
We look at from the very basic skills of getting dressed in the morning, brushing your teeth, feeding yourself, to more complex skills of being able to manage your finances, meal prep, driving a vehicle, getting back to work. So we scan it all. Whatever the client's goals are to getting back to a level of independence, that's what we're going to address.
What are some of the exercises or techniques or tools that you would use if I was one of your clients, say, and I had a traumatic brain injury because of a fall or whatever it is, something that is going to improve my motor skills and beyond my psychological needs too? What are some of the practices that you would run me through?
Well, it kind of depends on what specific therapy you're going to be addressing, but like we'll take physical therapy, for example. They do a lot of vestibular rehab, so if you're feeling dizzy, they're going to be working on their balance skills, the inner ear system, and taking you through different exercises, working on different strength and coordination movements to get you back to a safe level where you're no longer a fall at risk and you're not feeling that sense of dizziness. With vision therapy, it's a very specialized therapy that we offer here at Origami. There's specific tools that we use, and then also exercises, and it's a progression. It's not an overnight fix, unfortunately, but if the client is able to put in the time and the energy, we've seen amazing recoveries and amazing things happen here.
What is success to you? Is anyone ever really healed? I know it's a process. What is your standard for a successful outcome for anyone?
I think seeing progress, continued progress, it's not going to happen overnight. But a success story is, for me, is an individual that maybe they've sustained an injury, they've gone through their process, they've learned a certain sense of acceptance of the differences that have occurred, they've embraced those changes, and they're moving forward with whatever level of independence they now have. Will it be exactly the same as it was before? Probably not, but there's been a lot of cases that they're actually in a better situation because of whatever experiences that they've gone through. So it's really finding that balance of independence, acceptance, and being able to be that productive person, whatever that definition is, because it is so individually based.
As Tammy Hanna toured me around Origami, we stopped near the kitchen area where Chef Emily was making the midday meal.
And Emily is our chef, so she helps to prepare meals. But even though we have a chef, we still have our clients and they're encouraged. This is their home, help prepare their meals, have a say on the menu and what they like and what they don't like. And Emily, our chef, does a great job of really getting to know the person's likes, dislikes. And then we have a lot of dietary and swallowing precaution kind of medical needs that we always have to pay attention to as well. And right now you're hearing Eddie. He's communicating with our chef. He likes to tease her quite a bit.
Well, humor is a big part of this, right?
Absolutely. Humor heals. All right, you ready? What are you guys playing?
Another war, Audrey Love. 13-13.
No, no. We're playing war.
War. Are you winning, Audrey?
No.
Oh.
She was. I think she's making a comeback, though.
Tammy, there has been a culture in our country that has pervaded through the armed forces in years past, also in professional sports. Almost a culture of silence about traumatic brain injury. The idea of, well, suck it up, soldier or player. Any observations on how that culture is changing?
Absolutely. I've been in the brain injury industry a little over 15 years. And to reflect back 15, maybe even 10 years ago, it really is quite eye-opening how far we've come. There was a time where people would just, brush it under the rug. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, just dust it off and get back out there, whether it's a veteran, an athlete, whatever the case. But now, with there being greater awareness in the community for not only professional staff, but everyday laypersons, parents, loved ones of veterans going off to combat, there's a greater awareness. And with that, I think there's a greater acceptance. And there's also the outcomes that we're able to show that when somebody receives rehab for a brain injury, mild or severe, immediately, as soon as possible, their outcome is much greater. Their rehab is much more efficient, and they're able to get back to doing what they were doing, or at least as close to as possible. So you're right. I think the stigma is still there, and I think we still have a ways to go, but we've come a long ways over just the last decade of time.
Tammy Hanna is Executive Director of the Origami Brain Injury Rehabilitation Center in Mason. Tammy, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Imagine moving to a new country where you didn't speak the language, had no friends, and knew little about the culture. For refugees across the world, including right here in Lansing, it's more than a hypothetical question. It's their lives. For Neighbors in Action this week, we learn more about an organization that helps refugees that land in the Lansing area adjust to life in America. To talk to us about how they do that, we welcome Erica Brown Binion, the Executive Director of the Refugee Development Center. Erica, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Sure. How big is the need for these kinds of programs in Lansing? How big is the refugee population in our area?
Absolutely. Good question. I think it's quite unknown. We have, for most people, there's about 17,000 refugees who live in the Lansing area, and every year 600 to 700 new arrivals come to our community to make a new life for themselves.
And these are people who have not been naturalized, become citizens, anything like that?
They are
like
on
that.
The path to citizenship.
Okay.
All refugees have the option to become a citizen after 5 years, so they get a green card right away. These are legal citizens who come here as through the refugee resettlement process. It takes several years to actually be resettled in a community in the United States. Mm-hmm. Many of these people apply for refugee status when they are in a camp through the UN, and it takes the average time spent in a refugee camp is 17 years. We have many people who have spent the majority of their life in a camp. And then they apply for refugee status, and it takes several years for that to go through. There's many background checks, and many people want to go back to their home. So they wait several years before they apply to be resettled in a new community.
They hold on to hope that they're going to go, somehow find a way back.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the number one hope is that they can go back home. But sometimes situations do not improve, and the ability to go back home is not possible because of violence and persecution.
Well, if the average is 17 years, that means quite a few have spent more than 17 years in a refugee camp somewhere. When a family gets here and they've left everything they've known behind, what are their most immediate needs?
Yeah, so the basic needs are, you know, housing, food, shelter. And once that's met, they work through the resettlement agency. The RDC works closely with our resettlement agency here in Lansing, which is St. Vincent Catholic Charities and Lutheran Social Services. They do the resettlement work. Well, they'll meet someone at the airport and have a house for them and give them those basic needs. That's a program through the federal government. That lasts about 90 days. So they have basic needs, case management support, for only about 3 months, where they are expected to be self-sufficient after that time. And as we all know, that's really not possible. The Lansing community came together in 2002 and said, we need to have more support for refugees once they come so that they can really become self-sufficient.
And that's the origins of the Refugee Development Center?
Exactly.
That's where you come
That's in. Exactly where the Refugee Development Center came in.
And you get connected with the refugees. How exactly?
Right. One amazing part of the refugee resettlement community here in Lansing is that we work really collaboratively. So we work closely with St. Vincent Catholic Charities, and we work closely with Lutheran Social Services and other agencies that provide support to refugees. And our job is to provide educational services so that people can become self-sufficient. We do home visits with every new family that comes into Lansing to help them learn about the American school system. We do after-school programs in the highest refugee population schools right here in partnership with the Lansing School District. We do ESL classes so that people have the opportunity for free to learn English. We have evening and daytime classes, and they are bustling. We have so many people coming through our doors. In fact, we just started a daytime class, and we had to double it into two classes because so many people showed up. And we'll probably have to open up more classes because even that is at capacity now.
You are your goal here is self-sufficiency.
Absolutely. That is the goal of the refugee resettlement program at the national level.
What do you do between the time a refugee family first comes to you? So Lutheran Social Services, St. Vincent's is behind them when they come to you. What about the path? What's the biggest part of your job in terms of getting it self-sufficient?
It's a great question. So one of the things that we always struggle with is doing something for someone or teaching them how to do it. And our goal is education. So we are confronted with a number of problems that people may have, emerging needs based on the population we're dealing with. And our goal is to make sure that we teach someone how to solve that problem, whether it be filling out a job application or understanding how to make their children be successful in school or interacting with the Western education system. Many of them have had little experience with formal education at all. Some have had no formal education. So our goal is to teach them how to be successful in this community, in American society, how to learn savings. You know, financial literacy is a huge component of what we do. Just learning the language so that they can navigate the bus system, the grocery stores, those basic things that we take for granted because we grew up doing that. Mm-hmm. Teaching people how to feel comfortable in their new community and really become successful that's our goal. That's our mission.
We're talking with Erica Brown-Binion. She's the director of the Refugee Development Center, which provides support and education for newly arrived refugees in the Lansing area. This is Neighbors in Action here on WKAR's Current State. A lot of the work you do focuses on the kids in these refugee families. I can imagine as an adult, it would be really hard to make the decision to leave. But as a kid, you don't have a choice in the matter. How do you help them adjust to these upheavals in their lives?
Yeah, that's a really big challenge. And some of these kids have the only life they've known is in their refugee camp. One of the things that we do outside, we do after school programs, right? So that's the helping with their homework and some tutoring. But coupled with that, we do cultural adjustment workshops. So we have a very structured curriculum that we do with the children based on the needs that they come to us with. So some of them may have issues with interacting with their American peers or bullying or understanding how to sit still in the classroom or understanding how to communicate with their teacher effectively. So whatever those needs are, our curriculum is constantly changing. I'm a teacher by trade. I taught for a long time in elementary school. So one of my loves is developing that curriculum and helping meet the need based on our population that we're dealing with. So not just after-school tutoring. We make sure that we're meeting that social-emotional need of the students that we encounter, and that's a huge component of our program. It really sets us aside from just a traditional after-school program.
Given your line of work, there's a question I just have to ask you. Whether or not you're following, I'm sure you're aware of the hundreds of thousands of refugees that are going from the Middle East and North Africa to Europe. This is creating immense challenges. I'm just wondering if you ever think about that
and
what you make of this extraordinary situation.
Yeah, we're in a unique time. We have 60 million displaced people in the world right now. It's the largest number of displaced people we've had since World War II. We have the refugee crisis in Syria is the largest since the Rwandan genocide. We have 4 million Syrian refugees, and inside of Syria, 11 million who are internally displaced, half of the population of Syria. So that's one situation. We have situations in South Sudan, in Democratic Republic of Congo. I mean, the list goes on. So though the situations in all of those countries are not improving, and which is why we've seen the populations of internally displaced people, refugees, people seeking asylum continue to grow. And of course, that's something that we pay attention to, because what happens is we end up seeing many of them come
here.
That's
my next question. Is Lansing in for a lot more refugees as a result of what's happening across the ocean?
Yeah, the president announced a couple months ago an increase in the number of refugees that the United States will accept. Usually the ceiling for the last several years has been about 70,000 refugees. That is 70% of the total population of refugees that get resettled in a given year. So last year, 105,000 people were resettled across the world.
Are you up for this challenge?
Absolutely. I mean, we are prepared to...
The community has the resources. You feel you have the resources to accept more refugees.
We certainly are constantly seeking more funding so that we can support refugees. The majority of our funding goes directly to full-time staff so that they can provide direct hours of service to people who are here. And we've continued to grow. We have great support in this community. Lansing is a welcoming community.
Yeah.
Lansing really wraps its arms around
a lot of refugee activity here. I mean,
absolutely.
It's known as a hub, I think.
Yep. And agencies work together. We're a very collaborative community, which is why we're so welcoming.
It would seem you have to be.
Yeah.
You would have to be, it seems. You have an event coming up tomorrow. Tell us about what you have planned here for Thanks Lansing.
Thanks Lansing. We decided a couple of years ago to put on an event to make sure that there's an opportunity for our newcomer community and our American-born community to have interaction and learn from one another. So Thanks Lansing is that celebration. It's celebrating the diversity that we have here, an opportunity to taste very unique foods.
It's where and when?
It is tomorrow night. It's at the Lansing Public Media Center, which is at 2500 South Washington, just south of Rio Town, 5:30 to 7:30. We'll have great musical performances, lots of people, kids, families. It'll be a really fun time.
Erica Brown-Binion is the executive director of the Refugee Development Center, in Lansing. We've been talking about the organization's programs for refugees and their upcoming Thanks Lansing event. Erica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having
me. Good luck in the future. Current State is always looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out and email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line, please, or tweet us at KAR Current State and tell us a little about why you think they should be featured. And coming up on the program, the best year in Detroit history might have been 1963. The car business was booming, Motown was exploding. A new book from Pulitzer Prize winner David Marinus explores all that was right with the city that year. It's called Once a Great City. He talks with Current State's Scott Pohl. And we look once again to Michigan's past for more stories of pioneers in the field of aviation. This time, learn about Clem Sohn, also known as Michigan's Batman. We'll speak with Sandra Clark, director of the Michigan Historical Museum, where Sohn's outfit is currently on display. That and more after the break. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. You can catch all of our segments at WKAR.org. You can listen live at WKAR.org as well. I'm Mark Bayshore. To see Detroit at its best, you might have to go back about 50 years. Since then, the population has steadily declined. Homes are vacant, streetlights don't work, and the Motor City has struggled through a bankruptcy. But in 1963, the car business was booming, Motown was bursting onto the national music scene, and Martin Luther King Jr. tried out his I Have a Dream speech in Detroit a couple of months before making it famous in Washington. Current State Scott Pohl is here with more on a new book about Detroit in 1963. Who's the author, Scott?
Well, Mark, it's Pulitzer Prize winner David Marinus, associate editor of the Washington Post. He's the author of highly praised books about Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and Vince Lombardi. We discussed his newest book, Once in a Great City, A Detroit Story, ahead of a visit to Okemos to talk about it on Thursday.
David Marinus, welcome to Current State.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
You spent your early childhood in Detroit, but you haven't lived in the city for many years. What drew you to this story?
Well, you're right. I was born in Detroit. I spent my first 6.5 years there, and it was kind of buried deep inside me. And I was actually watching a commercial in 2011 during the Super Bowl with Eminem driving through the streets of Detroit and seeing the great iconic figures of Detroit, the Joe Louis Fist and the Diego Rivera mural and the Fox Theater.
This is the Motor City, and this is what we do.
It was a Chrysler commercial, just trying to sell cars, but it sold me on the idea of Detroit and what it meant to me and what it meant to the country, and that's when I started thinking about writing a book.
As you looked into Detroit, though, for this book, what turned out to be special about the year 1963, really an 18-month period that includes 1963? What was so special about this time in Detroit?
Well, I think it was a magical time. It was a time of great creativity and promise when Motown was just going off on its first country tour, Motortown Review, when cars were selling more than ever before, when labor under the United Auto Workers and Walter Reuther was very strong, when civil rights was an important factor in Detroit, and Martin Luther King came to the city and gave his I Have a Dream speech there before he did it in Washington. All of these elements of promise were there from 1962 to early 64, which is the period of my book. But you could also see sort of the shadows of what was to come, sadly.
Would you think it's fair to say that Detroit peaked in 1963?
You know, it probably in some ways peaked in the 1950s, to be honest with you, in terms of population. But in terms of its creative promise, I think it's fair to say that that was an incredible period, a magical period of 1963. And you could see even then, sociologists at Wayne State University in 1963 predicted the depopulation that would follow, that the city would lose about 500,000 people every decade, and that's exactly what happened. So in many ways, 63 was kind of a peak.
We're talking with David Marinus about his new book, Once in a Great City. It focuses on Detroit in 1963, perhaps a high water mark in Detroit's history. I want to talk about a few of the major players. You've mentioned Walter Reuther, but let's talk about the mayor. What was the political climate in Detroit like?
The mayor then was Jerome Cavanaugh. He was elected in 1961, largely with the help of a strong African-American vote, succeeding a mayor and a police department that had had very difficult problems with the black community. Cavanaugh was a liberal, progressive acolyte of John F. Kennedy. He was an Irish Catholic, tried to, with a large family, and sort of modeled his family after the Kennedys. And he came in with a progressive agenda that included trying to improve the relations with the blacks of Detroit.
To what degree would you say he succeeded in doing that?
Well, it's kind of part of the tragedy. He brought in a very progressive police chief. And when Martin Luther King came to Detroit in the summer of 63 for the Walk to Freedom, he was greeted at the airport by the police chief, who said, "There will be no police dogs attacking you here." This was right after Birmingham and the horrible incidents of police racism in the South. So there was a very strong effort, but in the end, it wasn't enough. And there was actually a shooting in Detroit that summer of an African-American prostitute by the police that led to sort of an early variation of things we'd seen over the last year in Ferguson, Missouri, and elsewhere. And then, of course, a few years later came the 1967 riots.
You bring up the Walk to Freedom, and of course, a big player in that is the Reverend C.L. Franklin. Talk about his role in the city of Detroit at this time.
What an amazing character. This is Aretha's father, a preacher at New Bethel Baptist Church in Detroit. Very flamboyant, colorful, a little bit looked on with apprehension by the establishment Black Ministerial Alliance because of his colorful ways. But he was a friend of Martin Luther King's, and he helped organize. He really was the key organizer of the Walk to Freedom, which at that time was the largest civil rights march in American history. Franklin was a tremendous preacher who would give sermons that could be attended by as many as 10,000 people. He traveled around the country with his daughters, including Aretha, sort of as a circuit preacher. And he was really quite not only flamboyant but articulate in his preachings.
Lots of us from Michigan are Motown music people, and 1963 really saw Berry Gordy Jr.'s Motown company burst onto the national scene. Motown really helped shape the image of Detroit in this era, didn't it?
Yeah, it sure did. And think about the incredible talent that was on that bus that left for the first Motown Review. It had Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, Marvin Gaye, Little Stevie Wonder at age 13, Mary Wells, Martha Reeves and the Vandellas. The Supremes were sort of the opening act. The Temptations were singing backup. The Marvelettes. It was Marvin Gaye. It was unlike any group before or since, really, in terms of its pure talent. And it was all created by Berry Gordy, who started with an $800 loan from his family to get Motown started a few years earlier.
If you want to step back in time in Detroit, there may be no better place to do that than Hitsville, USA.
I think that's true. You know, it's not there anymore. It left for Los Angeles in the early 1970s, but there is still the Motown Museum on West Grand Boulevard, and you can still get that great vibration going over there.
One of the major business figures in Detroit in this age, maybe the major figure, is Henry Ford II. Mm-hmm. Hank the Deuce, another major figure in your book. Talk about the business climate and Ford and the auto industry in 1963.
Well, as I said, they were selling the book starts. One of the opening scenes is the 1962 Detroit Auto Show, which introduced the 1963 models, which sold more than any in history. But Detroit was a little bit blinded by its short-term success. It was moving back to selling big cars, not seeing Japan on the horizon. But at the same time that those 1963 models were being introduced, Hank the Deuce and his top salesman slash vice president, Lee Iacocca, were developing a new car in private that would be unveiled at the end of my book, which was the Mustang, which had the greatest marketing campaign in automotive history.
David Marinus will visit Lansing on November 12th to talk about his newest book, Once in a Great City, looks at what might be the best year in Detroit history, 1963. You've hinted at this, but I want to expand on it a little bit. Were there early signs in 1963 that might have foretold the decline to come, the riots, the population decline, and ultimate bankruptcy?
Yeah, I think so. You know, people tend to blame Detroit's demise on factors that came later, from the riots to the city government pensions to municipal corruption. But you could see structurally that it was suffering already in 1963. I call it a luminescent time, but the brightness was actually a dying light. Structurally, the highways had actually made it easier for people to leave the city. Urban renewal, which African Americans called Negro removal, was unsettling the different neighborhoods in the city. The shopping centers were forming a ring around the city then, from Eastland to Westland. The auto industry was already leaving Detroit to its later regret in some cases, looking for short-term gains elsewhere. All of these factors were leading really productive taxpayers to leave the city and causing many of the problems that were to come.
You hadn't personally lived in Detroit in many years, but I know you spent time in Detroit while working on this book. Do you have some personal observations about modern-day Detroit?
Oh, yes. Every time I came back to Detroit, I visited 8 times during the research, and I would say that I do see more energy every time, and yet there are still severe, if not intractable, problems dealing with housing and jobs. You know, I went to visit the house where I lived as a 6-year-old, a flat on Dexter, and it was gone. It had been torn down, and probably 5 out of the 8 houses on that block were either gone or abandoned. So there is a renaissance in Detroit. Young people are moving there, foodies and techies and artists and people, young people who can invent their lives there. Major investors are coming into the downtown, but there still are wide swaths of Detroit that are pretty forlorn and need help.
What do you think people today who care about Detroit, love Detroit, what do you think people are to make of how great the city seemed to be in 1963? I mean, in the early 60s, Detroit was even a very close finalist for an International Olympic Games. Are there lessons to be learned by looking back at this era?
Well, I don't know quite what the lessons are, except to pay attention to all of the small signs that can lead to something and don't be blinded by short-term success. The larger lesson of Detroit is that it gave so much to this country, and we tend to blame Detroit for its own problems, and maybe it's starting to turn from a symbol of a city of ruins to a city of hope, and I think all of us should ask what we could do for Detroit, the city that gave so much to all of us.
It makes me think that people around the country could learn something from reading about Detroit history and seeing how it compares to modern-day Detroit.
Oh, I think absolutely. This Detroit is a symbol of America in so many ways, of urban America. And it's so this story is not just a story about Detroit, but about the problems and promise of this whole country.
David Marinus is an associate editor at The Washington Post. He'll talk about his new book, Once in a Great City, A Detroit Story, on November 12th. The Capital Area District Library is bringing him to Kinawa Middle School in Okemos starting at 7 p.m. Registration is required. David Marinus, great talking with you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Scott.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. You can communicate with us via email, since you're at your computer much of the day anyway, probably currentstate@wkar.org. You can also ring me directly, Mark Bayshore, 517-884-4776. Never hesitate. Michigan has a rich history of innovators in the world of aviation. The legendary Charles Lindbergh was born in Detroit, and there are lesser-known trailblazers like Skyman Philip Parmalee. Last week, we learned about the Clinton County man who's credited with flying America's first cargo flight. Today, we look at another of those pioneers who left his mark on history not by flying planes, but by jumping out of them. Clem Soane of Fowler, about 20 miles northwest of Lansing, was the first man to jump from planes and glide through the sky with man-made wings. That's right, he was the first Batman. Soane's wingsuit is currently on display at the Michigan Historical Museum. Here to tell us more about it is Museum Director Sandra Clark. Sandra, welcome.
Thank you.
What do we know about Clem Soane's early years in Fowler? And I guess he ended up in East Lansing as well. What do we know about that?
He's born in Fowler. He said later on that he loved watching hawks when he was a boy on a farm outside of Fowler. He was in just the gliding and the swooping and the soaring really caught his imagination. His mother died when he was 8 or 9 years old, and they moved into Lansing. He graduated from Lansing Eastern. So he's born in 1910. And about the time that Capital City Airport is getting going with all kinds of planes coming in and out of there, he's a teenager. Mm-hmm. So as soon as he graduates from high school here, he hooks up with a fellow named Art Davis, who does air shows. And they're everything from racing planes to taking them, doing loops and all of that sort of thing, stunts on them. So he learned to fly. But what he really liked, as you noted, was jumping out of planes.
How did that get started? I mean, do we know much about that?
Well, we know that the first thing they did was static jumps, where they jump out with a group of people and your parachute line was actually tied to the plane, so your parachute would open automatically.
I see, yeah.
And then he saw a guy named Spud Manning who was jumping out and wasn't pulling his ripcord immediately and doing free fall.
Pretty radical at the time, I imagine.
Very radical at the time. Very radical. And, you know, there's some daring and some competition in all of this. The free fallers would see how far they could go before they opened their parachute and who would chicken out first.
Sure.
Well, Soane then takes it to the next step because these guys are basically like someone parachuting today. They'll use their arms and their legs to balance themselves and kind of control their fall and direction a little bit, but he decides that with wings, he could actually glide. And so he works with Art Davis, said on his mother's sewing machine, this would be a stepmother now, gets tubular steel and develops these bat wings that are collapsible. So they're collapsed when he gets in the airplane, slows the plane, gets out of the front cockpit and jumps. And spreads these wings. He's also got a strip of cloth between his legs that act kind of like the tail of a bird in his
sure.
eyes.
Sure.
And actually manages to glide and, as he would say, soar.
And delay pulling the ripcord.
And delay pulling the ripcord till he's at about 1,000 feet or less.
Oh, boy.
Which anyone who parachutes today would never wait that long to pull the ripcord on their parachute. He did jump with two parachutes. He had a backup parachute, so he had one on his back and one in front. The Des Moines Tribune in 1935 described this. He was in Iowa he got paid to go places at fairs and things.
Barnstorming.
Shows. Barnstorming, yeah. And they said for a while he glided testing the wings. Then he zoomed first to the left, then to the right. Leveling out, shooting upward, and downward. He looped three times.
An adrenaline junkie.
Absolutely an adrenaline junkie, but very serious about figuring out how he could glide. He said that his goal was to be able to glide all the way down without a parachute someday.
And you have the suit on display at the museum. What kind of condition is it in?
It's in very good condition.
So it was well made.
It was well made. He only did this for 2 years. So and he was constantly trying to do bigger wings and get more time gliding in the air. So they were not overused things by any means.
Do you have anything else beside the suit?
We have his goggles. We have a little piece of brass, kind of a fern-shaped thing that was on his coffin. He died in France at an air show, so it came back when his body was returned. A real tragic story. He was delayed in getting there. Boat was delayed. They got there at the very, very last minute, and he didn't check his parachutes before he jumped.
Oh.
And they did not open, neither the first or the secondary parachute opened. So we have this little piece of brass that came back. the case for the coffins, and we have a canvas case for the wings.
Do we know, did that create, I mean, was he a well-known enough guy by that point? I mean, he's performing in Paris air shows.
Yes.
Was he well enough known at that time that it created this was quite the story back here in Clinton County?
This was front page news, and it was news all over the country. He's in Popular Mechanics. He's featured in Newsweek. It was a pretty short career that he was doing this, but he really has a national reputation. People know about him. He also performed in Great Britain at air shows in that time span. So
we're talking about Michigan's Batman. He's from Clinton County, no less, Clem Soane, and we're learning about him from Sandra Clark, director of the Michigan Historical Museum, where Soane's outfit is currently on display. I'm told a bag of flour is related to this story. How so?
Well, when you jump out as high as he did, he figured out people couldn't actually see him when he first jumped off the airplane. So he had a bag of flour that he would attach and open so that he left a white trail of where he was until they could pick him up and watch him doing his jumps. And then, I mean, this guy, he's an inventor and an innovator. He figures out that an easier way to do that is with chemical smoke. So eventually he has a little canister of chemical smoke that is in the thing between his legs that he releases. So now he has smoke following him down. But that idea of getting people's attention so they can see as much as they can see of him.
I'm curious if he ever talked about something going wrong. Do we know that?
Did he ever say,
if anything happens to me, then I want this, that... Or did he feel like he was absolutely indestructible?
He felt like he was very safe at this. The double parachutes, he'd figured out how to brace these wings so they couldn't pull his arms back too far. When he was asked before he went up in Paris, he said he was just as comfortable as being in his grandmother's kitchen.
Wow.
Which is very sad. People thought he knew he did know what he was doing. Mm-hmm. But he made obviously one serious mistake in his haste. And didn't unpack the parachutes, check them out. They'd come over by boat, so likely they had gotten damp because they released, but they didn't unfold.
I see.
Yeah.
Michigan has had many interesting figures in the field of aviation. Just last week we learned about Philip Parmalee, who made the first cargo flight by air, another Clinton County guy.
Yeah.
Who else can you tell us about?
Well, a couple of people that come out of that same Clinton County experience. Babe Ruth is one of the early women pilots. By the time she was 16, she was taking flying lessons at Capital City Airport. And she was a good enough pilot that in World War II, she trained pilots for the Army Air Force in how to fly by instruments.
How about that?
And she,
Babe Ruth.
Babe was not her, Marion was her original name, but she was known around town as Babe Ruth, lived a long life, was a local historian of flight in her later years, and a real spokesperson for that age when people were really figuring out this whole flight thing. The other one that I think is fascinating is Talbert Abrams, Ted Abrams.
Certainly.
He remembered when he was 8, this is 1903, when his dad came home and told him about the Wright brothers.
Abrams Planetarium. That's right. And a very successful aerial photography business.
Yeah. These folks are trying to make money out of this stuff, and he figures out that people are as interested in the pictures he takes as in getting the plane and paying to ride up with him.
When and where can we see the Michigan Batman's outfit?
The Batman's outfit
is this part of your permanent collection?
This is in our permanent collection.
It belongs more with you, as much with you as anybody,
yeah.
I would imagine.
Yeah. No, this came in the 1950s. A man named John Hutchins, I would guess from the records, knew about Clem Soane and collected, because part of it comes from his stepmother, part of it comes from a cousin, and part of it was something that Hutchins brought in 10 years later. So this is in our main entrance lobby all by itself as a special exhibit. It'll be there till December 6th. We're open 7 days a week.
We've been talking with the director of the Michigan Historical Museum since 1991, Sandra Clark, and we've been talking about Michigan's Batman, Clem Soane of Fowler, the first man to jump from planes and glide through the sky with man-made wings and always daring himself to pull that ripcord later and later. Sandra Clark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll chat with Maestro Enrique Domecq about the Flint Symphony's concert this weekend, where the maestro will break down Mahler's superstitious Ninth Symphony into bite-sized pieces. Also, the State Board of Education has adopted new science standards for Michigan's K-12 students. We'll learn more from our local Michigan Teacher of the Year from a few years back, Rob Stevenson. Rob hosts Curious Crew on WKAR-TV, and he is all about science education. Plus, we'll learn more about Saturday's extraordinary halftime show at Spartan Stadium. It's been designed and choreographed by the woman who did the opening and closing ceremonies in the Beijing Olympics a few years back. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. Hope you can join us. Don't forget, we're always at WKAR.org. Connect with us on social media. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State on WKAR. Have a great day.